Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our version of the beach in Amelia Island, Florida. We're glad you could join us here. This morning's topic, we're going to discuss transparency, and transparency specifically as it relates to the philanthropic sector and foundations. Transparency, I contend, is an overused word, often portrayed and presented as if it were an end in itself, as opposed to a means to achieve an end. So transparency, there's often confusion about, well, what does transparency mean? And is transparency something to be ascribed to merely because transparency is an inherent good in itself, or because transparency can facilitate something else, like credibility or efficiency or accountability or litigation or redistribution? And in some ways, part of what the transparency conversation lacks is a framework for transparency, what it means, and to what ends. And often the conversation is it's confusing about whether or not the conversation is one of legal mandates, legally mandated increased transparency, legal minimums, and in some cases the legal standards become the cap, the maximum that transparency, the maximum to be achieved. The purpose of this panel, though, is not necessarily to debate those specific issues. Those issues would take more than a 75-minute panel to really do justice to the conversation. What we hope to accomplish today in this panel is we've assembled three folks who have expertise and experience in different ways and different degrees with thinking about transparency, thinking about it for their own experiences, their own organizations, thinking about it for the sector as a whole, and thinking about why transparency, why not transparency, and how to achieve transparency. So what we're going to talk about this morning is not debating should there be more or less legally mandated transparency, but what is it good for foundations to think about when they're thinking about transparency? Should they think about transparency? And if the answer is yes, what are some ways to think about it? Why be more transparent than what the law requires? Why be concerned about an overabundance of transparency? And then we'll talk some about ways to pursue transparency if the decision is made in the individual foundation context to undertake greater transparency than what the law requires. Now, because what we've got set up here is what we're hoping to have is a dialogue around those three topics. Don't have set presentations, so would ask if there is media here that this be treated as off the record, as background, and so that we can facilitate the conversation as opposed to presentations and make that be easier.
Yeah, I think we also... no tweeting. That's what we agree on. No tweeting.
Are there tweeters here?
I'll holster those.
Yeah.
So this is a secret conversation about transparency.
That's right. I think you... I'm going to have a hard job.
Yeah.
Which is part of the beauty of the panel. Let me introduce Darren McKeever. I'll say on the far right. Darren is with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He's a senior program officer on the policy and government affairs team. I'm actually going to give more of a bio on Darren because his bio is not in the materials. Darren leads the foundation's charitable sector work. He serves as an ambassador for the foundation within the charitable community managing the foundation's relationships and grants with associations, advocacy organizations, and research institutions that have interests in philanthropy and the nonprofit sector as a whole. So he looks at these things both from a Gates Foundation perspective, but more importantly for our purposes, the broader charitable sector, philanthropic sector perspective. He also monitors policy developments affecting the sector for the foundation. Prior to joining the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Darren was executive director and co-founder of Heads Up, a Washington, D.C.-based provider of academic and enrichment programs. For his efforts launching and leading the organization, Darren was awarded the Echoing Green and Stride Right Community Service Fellowship. In the center, again, not politically necessarily, but I think maybe.
I like to be in the center.
I think is Brad Smith, the president of the Foundation Center. Before joining the Foundation Center in 2008, Brad was president of the Oak Foundation in Geneva, Switzerland. And before joining the Oak Foundation, he developed and led the Ford Foundation's Peace and Social Justice Program. And to my right is Andrew Schultz, our resident comedian, and the Vice President for Legal and Government Relations for the Council on Foundations, and Andrew also heads the Council's Public Policy Department. So with that, and looking at sort of the three questions we've talked about, by the way, we, as most panels do, we talk about the session. You will notice this is so well organized, we've coordinated our suits. Ties we left up to the discretion of the panel. The first topic is, why should individual foundations consider greater degrees of transparency than what would be mandated by the law? And what I thought we'd do is start with Darren,
sure.
and then we'll pick up the conversation from there.
So first off, thank you to John and to Sue for inviting me to be a part of the panel and for accepting me as a late entrant to this discussion. I also want to thank Adam and the Philanthropy Roundtable for organizing what I think has been a great conference. I've been with the Gates Foundation since 2008, and I've made a point of coming to the Roundtable conferences every year, so this is my third conference, and I'm pleased to be here again. I wanted to maybe start by just talking about the Internet, because I think the Internet... and it's not just because I work at the Gates Foundation, but I think the Internet, if it demonstrates anything besides how easy it is to track down ex-girlfriends or ex-boyfriends or how easy it is for them to track you down, it's this, that knowledge is truly distributed and that even the largest institutions in our society cannot claim a monopoly on wisdom or expertise in this day and age. And that the solution to some of our most vexing challenges can lie within a single individual or a very small institution. And so I come at this question from that context, that framework, believing that solutions to problems can exist anywhere. And so what I see transparency, as you were saying, as a means to an end, it's a means for spreading that knowledge. I'll just give you one brief example. When I came here this week, I was not sure of all the people who would be attending, but Adam, in his opening speech, he talked about a number of foundations that were involved in some very cool efforts. And one of the foundations that they mentioned was the Noble Foundation. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if anybody is here with the Noble Foundation. Mary Kate, right? And Adam said, Noble Foundation is working on plant science and agriculture in Oklahoma. Well, Gates Foundation has a program in agricultural development. Immediately I heard that and I said, gosh, I wonder whether we've had any connections or whether there might be any sort of knowledge or experience or expertise that could be shared between our foundations. I happened to, at lunch yesterday, sit next to Donna and at Mary Kate's table, and it was pure coincidence that we happened to sit next to each other. Now, imagine a world where the Gates Foundation shared nothing about our activities, that nobody knew that we were working on agricultural development in Africa. And Adam did not make that speech, or rather, he gave that speech but didn't mention that the Noble Foundation was working on these issues. we would have not been able to find each other even as quickly as we did. And I think that sharing more information about our activities makes those kinds of conversations much more easy to happen. So I start with that first principle. That seems to me to be a really good reason to share information. I think there are some other benefits to foundations specifically, and I'm sure we'll get into it, but I wanted to lead with that comment.
So collaboration opportunities to work together.
Exactly.
At least know what's going on.
Right.
Yeah. Brad, do you want to add?
Yeah, let me just make a sort of an amendment to what Darren talked about. The primary disclosure document for foundations is the 990 PF tax return. And I actually brought a prop here. So this is a 990, and it happens to be actually for a foundation called the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation. Mm. So I think, John, you're probably familiar with this document, right?
You may have seen it.
This is pretty representative. It's about 175 pages or so. And at the Foundation Center, we collect these for all of the grant-making institutions in the U.S. That includes private foundations, corporate foundations, community foundations, and a growing body of grant-making public charities. These are nonprofits that receive grants and then re-grant or make grants. All told, there's about 98,000 of these in the U.S. Now, I just did one of these kind of Ronald Reagan-type calculations. I figured probably the average 990 is about half an inch thick, and if you strung them all together side by side like this, they would extend out for over a mile. So if we are a sector that, as I think we are realizing that more and more we need to collaborate with each other, and the scale of the problems we're working on really cannot be solved by the efforts of one individual foundation alone, or rarely can be. There's a very practical problem, is how do you know what your colleague foundations are doing? This is what Darren's alluding to. You might be lucky enough to go to a conference and hear somebody speak or sit next to somebody, but how do you really know what your colleagues are doing? And in the big foundations, the big staffed foundations, I worked in one of them for many years, it was difficult enough to even know what we were doing within our own foundation, let alone what others were doing. So their transparency serves a very practical purpose, which is to know what your colleague foundations are doing and to identify opportunities. The Foundation Center historically has collected this information and processed it and made it possible through publications and databases so that nonprofits could find grants. That's another big purpose. I mean, if you're a poor nonprofit and you're trying to wade through 97,000 of these to try to find what foundations are interested and target your proposals, imagine what a task that is. So the transparency serves that function. The other function I think it serves is, to use a sports metaphor, I think the best defense is a good offense. And as foundations are in some way expected to serve the public good, at least that's their purpose or their mission. And transparency is a very good way to show how that's being done. And I think to the extent that the sector shows that there's a lot of creativity going on in the ways it's being transparent, the less likely it is that there'll be sort of punitive one-size-fits-all legislation. And we'll talk about this later, but that doesn't mean that every single foundation has to be transparent in the same way. It means that somehow the sector needs to be able to convey the idea that, or the impression that it is not sort of a closed club.
Andrew, do you have thoughts?
Just a couple. One, I want to articulate the difference between transparency and disclosure. And I think one of the things people equate the two, and anyone who's ever been a litigator knows that the fastest way to bury something is to disclose everything. And so when you're sorting through warehouses full of documents looking for the one memo, I mean, if you really want to be non-transparent, you just print out every single email you've ever on your server and you say, yeah, it's in there somewhere. Disclosure and transparency are two different things. I do very much want to align myself with John's opening remarks, which is that transparency is not in and of itself an ends, it's a means. And so if the question on the table is when is transparency appropriate, it's like, when it's helpful, and when it's not is when it isn't. And that's a very lawyerly answer. So the answer is it depends. but I think we have to be very thoughtful about what is the problem, what is the issue that we're trying to address, and does disclosure and or transparency get us to that end, and what are the trade-offs? It's all cost-benefit analysis. That's what and everybody should be, you know, thinking deliberately about whether or not being transparent about particular items of information is a useful thing on the whole or is not particularly useful. And as long as we're having that conversation and thinking deliberately about it all the time, I'm confident that we as a field trying to do the best for the most people will come up with the right answer. And I think if nothing else, we come out of this saying, let's just think about it in every case. Does it make sense? What are the pros and cons? We'll be a better field for it. The knee-jerk reactions like disclose everything all the time or don't ever disclose anything are disruptive at the fringes, and that's not really where we want to get to.
If I could add to these comments, in particular Brad's comment about the notion of transparency and its linkages to preserving public trust or reinforcing public trust in our institutions. Oftentimes, the conversations in these rooms about transparency, about public trust, goes to public trust in our institutions themselves. But it's oftentimes the causes that we're supporting or the individual programs that we're supporting that could benefit from additional transparency. Just to give you one example that we've been involved in, it's something called the Living Proof Project, where anybody involved in overseas development assistance, foreign aid, there's a lot of skepticism about the value of governments or anybody spending on overseas assistance. And there are good reasons to be skeptical. But we thought it was particularly important to talk about the success stories. And that's why this Living Proof Project that Bill and Melinda launched last year, there's going to be another event next week in Europe, to talk about what happens to those dollars? Where do they actually go? Who do they actually benefit? Whose lives do they actually save? So it's not just about reinforcing public trust in our own institutions, which could be seen as purely in self-interest, but it's oftentimes valuable for the programs and causes that we all support.
You know, Brad, at the introduction, you mentioned tweeting and Twitter. Darren, you mentioned the Internet. Mm-hmm. One of the other things, and Brad, if you want to talk about it a little bit, how has the Internet and technology affected transparency?
I think radically and completely. We live in a world where, I think, technology aside, there is growing mistrust of large institutions. I mean, if you think about any sector, which... You know, name a sector that has not undergone a major crisis or in which public trust has been severely eroded. The Catholic Church, major corporations, I mean, government for many years. And it would, I think, be naive to think that somehow foundations, especially with the growth of very large foundations like the Gates Foundation, and I guarantee you that within the next 10 to 20 years, Gates will not be the largest foundation. There will be yet another foundation even bigger than Gates. These are targets for public scrutiny. And technology, what's changed is it's given the public the means to get all sorts of information about you and your organizations, whether you want them to or not. That's just reality. And it may be uncomfortable, but it has really reshaped privacy. Add to that, you have a whole new generation. If Facebook is any kind of indicator, who also think of privacy in a very different way than most of us in this room do. There's a wonderful presentation, if you've never seen it, by David McCandless on TED Talks about data visualization. And he just shows a bunch of graphs and different kinds of things and then asks the audience, what do you think this is? And there's a great one that has several years of data with big peaks in April and December. And he asked people, what do you think this is? And somebody says, oh, I don't know, the consumption of chocolate in the United States. And he goes, no, but that might be useful in this case. And he goes through a few of those. What it turns out to be is a graph that shows the incidence of breakups on Facebook. And it turns out that April and December, April spring break, December, you know, you're going home, and so there's this peak. Yeah.
I thought it was because it was tax day.
So there's, I haven't seen an equivalent graph on foundations, but, you know, just wait. It's coming, I'm sure.
A new way to break up with grantees would be Facebook.
Right?
Yeah, I think, and part of what technology has done, and you know, Brad has made this point, technology and its permutations throughout our culture now mean that those who have the information don't necessarily have the control over the information that we used to have.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons to consider being more transparent than what the law allows is to be able to try to control the message
exactly.
that you want to communicate, that you want to be out there, to the extent you can. So you can help portray and present the accurate information that reflects your foundation.
Yeah, but I also want to say, I think that's an excellent point, but also it goes back to this idea that transparency isn't always right and it isn't always wrong,
right.
And that the internet makes us have to be a lot more thoughtful about the unintended consequences of knee-jerk transparency, and I'm by no means suggesting that transparency is a bad thing, but in particular areas, when we talk about international grant making and work that foundations are doing that is just critical to communities in distress overseas, where in some cases, and when you go back to the Treasury guidelines on, you know, international grant making and the disclosures it called for, you know, there was an appropriate hue and cry from a lot of the NGO community about, you know, we start listing names of grantees and board members, like, people die.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think, so that's one of the things, again, my point about transparency is simply to think about it in every case and what the pros and cons are and what the risks are. And there can be real, and one of the areas to be very thoughtful about or what are the, you know, depending on who you're serving, what the implications for that are in the community in which they reside, you know, being very careful and having an obligation towards that data. You know, I think there's always a solution. You can report things in the aggregate, or you can, you know, report things at a meta level instead of at the incremental level. There are ways to do disclosure, but if you're not thinking thoughtfully about what the implications are, you could end up doing more harm than good.
Yeah,
so you just need to be thoughtful about it.
Yeah, although I would take some exception with that, because I hear this argument all the time. When we're talking about transparency, it says, oh, but I make grants for a human rights defender or a battered women's shelter. It's a very small minority of grant making
mm-hmm.
that, if information was revealed, could actually put somebody's life in danger.
Mm-hmm.
That does not by any stretch of the imagination represent even 90% of the grant making done by foundations. And as you say, there are ways to control that information. One of the ways that foundations do that most commonly is if they're making a grant for something that they feel is too controversial or too close to the line on lobbying restrictions or other things, they will make a general support grant. And there are foundations, as we know very well, that flag their own internal information in a way that grants that are particularly sensitive are not reported. They may be on a 990 in some way, but they're not reported in any kind of public way that that can be picked up and put somebody in danger. So,
right.
Yeah. I would not let the exceptions.
No, that's right. Absolutely. Right.
Mm-hmm. But and to, you know, to that point, part of what both of you are saying is that be strategic and thoughtful on case by case basis.
Be responsible
on how to do
right.
things. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and we've transitioned now, you know, in some ways into some of the reasons to be concerned about over transparency or over exposure. Yeah, you guys have both had a chance to comment. Darren, do you want to chime in here?
I think in your opening comments, you said transparency is often used as sort of a value in itself, that it's an end. And I think you appropriately said it's more a means to an end. And I think the other misconception sometimes about issues of transparency is that it's not free and it's not without trade-offs, as we were talking about. I mean, I think... For our foundation, we need to constantly weigh, okay, what are the financial, what are the costs and benefits of sharing particular pieces of information when weighed against the use of those resources to fund a grantee at a higher level? We're working on vaccine development where we have a pretty good sense of how much it costs to save a life. And when factored in, you know, how much do we spend on communications, how much do we spend on our website, against that very real consideration, and I don't mean to over-dramatize it, but that, you do need to consider those trade-offs as to where you allocate those resources. And to the extent that oftentimes communications is much more of a fixed cost, or at least it has lower marginal costs, I think larger institutions are sometimes in a better position to make some, they have a different formula or different trade-offs to consider, and I don't want to pretend otherwise. But I do think it's very important to weigh those costs and benefits. Let me stop there and see. I know there are other points I want to make. But
yeah, I'd say two reasons. I worked for a family foundation that's in Switzerland, and it was really a family foundation. It was the husband, the wife, and the three kids. That was the board. And they were very concerned about their own privacy. Mm-hmm. They did not operate under the disclosure laws of the U.S. because their money was offshore and they were physically located in Switzerland. But they were very concerned that if people ever really realized how much money they had, and they had an enormous amount of money, they were billionaires, that they would never have a minute's privacy, and they valued that. And they were worried very much about the safety of their grandchildren. And for me, this was a real wake-up call in some ways. I mean, obviously, you know, not having, you know, having that kind of personal wealth myself, it was very difficult for me to imagine those concerns. But working closely with this family made me realize how real those concerns were. They really were concerned about these things, and I think with good reason. So that foundation has become more transparent, but for other reasons we can get into to later, for business reasons. But the other limit, I would say, is that you often hear, you know, the most vocal critics of foundations are people that were turned down for grants. this may come as a surprise, I know. But, and I've heard from some of these advocates that they demand that the internal documents that were used to make decisions about grant and turn down grants should be made public. I think there is absolutely no constructive purpose to be served by making those documents public. And I cannot envision any degree of transparency in which releasing that kind of documentation would be warranted or be constructive in any way.
Yeah, and I just want to pick up on that. I think the questions about transparency, and the first thing is to whom, about what, and that's always an important thing. And I listed the thing of, like, to whom are we talking about being accountable? To the government. I mean, that's an issue. To the general public, to potential grantees. I have on my list of rejected grantees, and I've heard the arguments as well. To collaborators, to competitors, like, who are we talking about being accountable to, and about what? And I think grant making, as far as to whom money ultimately flowed and what the purpose of it was, with the and a point well taken about the exceptions, not letting the exceptions justify everything else. But, you know, I find that transparency about your ultimate grantees and what they're doing, there are a few cases where significant and open transparency isn't really just the way to go. You mentioned internal processes. Like, I absolutely, the basis, you know, you should be transparent about how you make decisions, but not about sort of the way the decisions were made and who. And this comes up a lot in the governance context. And should minutes be publicly available? And this is obviously different for organizations like community foundations and private family foundations, et cetera. But, you know, I have seen every level of details in minutes, from a four-day meeting that is can be summarized in 2.5 pages to a 3-hour meeting that is basically a verbatim transcript. And the question is, what are the trade-offs? And it goes back to that. And if you're disclosing every attributable statement to what everyone has said, and everyone else, people make different statements, and you could squelch debate. So I think it's very important to think about what level of disclosure, about what, and to whom we're making disclosures. And I agree completely with Brad about privacy considerations and, to, you know, who does it help to air the dirty laundry of why a particular grantee didn't get a grant. But we should be transparent about, you know, that we do have a process and what the process is, if not exactly how that process played out in every situation. But I think those are the kind of questions we need to ask ourselves.
And Darren, you said you had a few other things.
I've got a lot on my mind.
are there other things you want to add?
Sure. One other thought. I was having dinner with a recently appointed president of a foundation, a fairly substantial foundation, and he related this story to me of sitting down with some communication staffers that had a long-term contract with this foundation. And the communications folks were saying, here's our PR plan, this is the kind of media that we want to get. And he said, wait a second. Why do we want any media attention? And the concern that he had was a very practical one. He said, you put me on Oprah, or you put me even on the local show, the local news show, the number of scholarship applications that are going to come into my door is going to go through the roof. And I can't process, let alone fund, all of those folks. And we need to be very careful about what sharing information about our activities could generate, just in terms of workload. Mm-hmm. Again, these are all these different considerations to play in. And I think that was a legitimate concern.
Can I provoke Darren for a minute? I mean, yeah. I guess if I were a critic of foundations, I would say, well, wait a minute, okay. You're supposed to have a public purpose, but somehow you're protecting yourself from the public? I mean, you don't want to get applications? I mean, you're running a scholarship. Why wouldn't you want to get as many applications as possible?
Well, let me put it differently, where the transparency actually works in the favor, where disclosure about how or what the criteria one uses for making scholarship decisions or grants, where if you say up front, these are the kinds of individuals that we'll accept applications from, these are the kinds of activities that we'll support, that in many ways cuts down on the volume of applications. Right. So it doesn't it works both ways, and I don't mean to simplify the issue.
Well, and some of that, though, too, is balancing, and Darren, earlier you were talking about balancing costs.
Right.
And needing to make decisions about financial costs. We've also got to balance the time and energy and dedication of staff to the issues of transparency themselves. How are you going to be transparent? But then the consequences of that, which is what the story we're relaying about this other person, mm-hmm. to be overwhelmed with grant applications, most of whom are going to get rejected mm-hmm. because they've got a limited amount of money, that takes time that's got to be balanced. How much time, limited chunks, can be dedicated to reviewing those particular applications versus other things the foundation or the donor might be doing.
And Brad knows the statistics far better than I do, but of the 72,000-73,000 foundations in the U.S., 80% or more do not have any staff. Is that right?
No, it's, back up. Statistics have to be careful. We did a survey of 11,000 foundations, which was sort of a representative sample, and that survey showed that 76% of those 11,000 foundations had 4 staff or fewer. Okay, so that gives you an idea of the...
Yeah. I heard that 50% of statistics are made up. I just made that up. So.
Not these.
What are you saying, Andrew?
No, Brad's statistics are always accurate.
That's right.
Well, let's go ahead and turn the conversation now to having gone through some analysis of reasons to consider being more transparent than the law mandates and reasons not to, reasons to be careful and strategic and thoughtful. Let's talk a little bit about how foundations might consider being more transparent. Brad, I thought we'd start with you on this.
Yeah, do you mind if I show a few?
Right. Okay. As Brad's walking over here, one of the Foundation Center's recent marquee programs is its Glass Pockets program, which is a means by which to help foundations with their efforts to be transparent.
Okay. I want to back up just... Whoops.
Next slide.
Okay. Back up just a little bit. This quote here. So far as there is a justification, and I'm sure there is, for the existence of these institutions, it is that they serve the public good. If they are not willing to tell what they do to serve the public good, then as far as I'm concerned, they ought to be closed down. Now, who do you think might have said that? Well, Maybe it was this guy. This is Pablo Eisenberg. I don't know how many of you know Pablo Eisenberg, but he can always be counted upon to beat up on foundations. He never misses an opportunity. You know, maybe it was these guys. Maybe it was the Greenlining Institute, you know, the authors of AB 624 in California. Or maybe it was that everybody's favorite, right? Senator Grassley. Well, actually, it was this guy. This is Russell Leffingwell. He was a Republican banker in 1952. He was the chairman of the Carnegie Corporation, the Carnegie Foundation, and he was testifying before the Cox Commission, which was a congressionally convened commission to investigate foundations for support of un-American activities. And he said this. He said, "We think the foundation should have glass pockets." And it was this quote that was used in 1956, a few years later, when the Foundation Center was created. And a lot of people think of the Foundation Center as the place nonprofits go to find a grant. But its real purpose was as an offensive maneuver, basically. Coming in the wake of these hearings, foundation leaders led by John Gardner, who was at Carnegie at the time, got together and said, the best way to protect ourselves against this kind of suspicion is to prove that we have nothing to hide, to have glass pockets. So glass pockets, okay, 990. What you hear most commonly is, well, we are transparent. We do 990s. And this is a terrible image of a 990, but it's instructive because it is filled out in pen. And we collect all these, and we've seen worse. We get them filled out in pencil still. And for us to extract information from these, we have to optically scan them. We send them halfway around the world to have them optically scanned, and then we bring them back, and we try to pull all sorts of information from them so people can understand what foundations are doing. This is what it's like to get information from a 990 filled out pen or pencil, okay? So, you know, this is sort of the state of information of our field. And meanwhile, you know, this guy needs no introduction. Steve Jobs of Apple. Meanwhile, this is what's going on in the world. 4.6 billion mobile phone subscriptions worldwide. If you have a mobile phone, you have the internet now. And 1 to 2 billion people actually using the internet. This is the world we live in. But philanthropy is not quite there yet. The Foundation Center decided to go back to its roots and launch a website, as John said, called Glass Pockets. It actually has a separate URL. It's www.glasspockets.org. And the whole purpose was really to try to sort of facilitate, inspire greater transparency among foundations. It's organized according to different kinds of content. It has basic facts about philanthropy. This top thing is kind of fun if you want to play with a time slider. It actually shows in a dynamic way the growth of foundations and foundation assets over time by state since 1975. It's really kind of fun to see, especially the state of Washington, where when the Gates Foundation appears all of a sudden. And then this is... this pie chart below is quite interesting. It's this survey of the 11,000 foundations I mentioned, and it has a very interesting statistic. We found that only 29% of those 11,000 had websites or issued reports. So, you know, if you're the public or you're a legislator and you're wondering what the sector does, you know, they're not all foundations really are that forthcoming with information, so you could have questions. We also wanted to show in this website that what foundations do is relevant to the issues that people really care about. This is just a landing page for something we developed for the Global Philanthropy Forum. I think some of you heard Jane Wales the other night. And she organizes this big meeting of donors to talk about world issues. And so if you click deep into this, you'll get all sorts of information about what foundations are doing about these incredibly important issues in the world and what's still needed and what's working. But the most relevant part to what we're talking about today is a section called Looking Inside Foundations. And it has different information on it about what foundations themselves are doing voluntarily to be more transparent. One feature of this is profiles that are being done of individual foundations based on 23 transparency criteria that our staff observed from the practice of foundations on the internet. We didn't invent any of these. We pulled these from what foundations are already doing and broke them down into a number of categories. So here you're looking at the California Endowment, for example. And part of the criteria is basic information. Okay. Do you have general contact information on your website? You'd be surprised how many foundations don't have any contact information if they have a website. Do you put your mission statement? Seems obvious, but not all foundations put their mission statement on their website. Governance and information, your bylaws, committee charters, code of conduct policies if you have one, conflict of interest, board of directors list. A lot of times there's not a board of directors list. These are very common things in the corporate world, and they're beginning to find their way into the foundation world. There's also information there on finances. Do you put your financial statement up there? Do you put your 990? Grant-making information, do you describe your process? We were talking about that. Do you say what your strategy and priorities are so people have an idea of what, you know, what your criteria are? Do you have any kind of information on your past grants so people can see the kinds of things you fund? Performance measurements. Do you measure your own performance in any way? I mean, foundations are very interested in their grantees measuring performance. They really want to know who's effective and whatnot. And a lot of times nonprofits ask, well, how effective are foundations? And how are we going to know how effective they are? And more foundations are doing their assessments, and more of them are putting them online. I think some of you have probably done the Center for Effective Philanthropy Studies, which your grantees are sort of anonymously surveyed about how you're performing. And some foundations put those online as a self-evaluation. So this is just a series of criteria, and we go to foundations, we say, you know, would you like to have your profile online? We work with them to fill this out. It either has a blank next to each criteria or a magnifying glass. The magnifying glass, if you click it, goes directly to that part of your website so people can see. And in only one case has a foundation gone through the process and said, no, we'd rather not have this put up. And we never disclosed who it was, and we never put it up. And a few foundations, particularly smaller foundations, have been stepping forward and saying that we want the public to know that we're transparent. So this is a great way just to see what your peers are doing and get information. There's no score. There's no rating. So this is not a rating process. The other interesting piece on this I want to bring to your attention is what we call Foundation Transparency 2.0. And what we did is we looked through hundreds and hundreds of foundation websites, and we pulled together all the use of social media. And you can search it by foundation, like you see the Gates Foundation. Of course, you'd expect the Gates Foundation to be using everything, Twitter, YouTube, Flickr, you know, you can imagine. But you can also sort it by type of social media. So if you want to see what foundations are doing on YouTube, you can click YouTube and you can see all the foundations that are using YouTube or all the ones that are using Facebook. And you can sort of see and if something works for you or doesn't, or you can get in touch with that foundation. And I just wanted to show you that it's not only the big foundations. The Gordon Hartman Family Foundation here has about $12 billion in assets, spends $433,000 a year. And they're using Twitter and Facebook. And I took a look. If you click this, you go right to their Twitter feed or Facebook. And they're using it, actually, because they work with disabilities. And they're using it to sort of start a whole dialogue with nonprofits and other foundations about disability work and to leverage their own resources. So there's a way in which these kinds of tools can really help you be transparent and also fulfill your mission. So that's a little bit about this site. If you want to take a look at it, there's a lot more information on it. But it's intended really to be a resource for the field so you can see what your peers are doing, because this is like any other sector. We learn from our peers much more than from our critics.
Thank you, Brad. Andrew, do you want to talk about some ways that transparency can be implemented?
Yeah, sure. And one thing I would say, and this is actually inspired by a comment someone made yesterday about how our sector is good about talking about failure. And, you know, that's sort of true and sort of not true. And I'm the son of a scientist, and science is replete with examples of where a failed experiment yielded better results than a successful one. And I feel we are pretty good internally talking about failure. But I think that where there's a real lack of, and it's not, you know, transparency seems like the wrong word there, but sharing of information among ourselves with one another about things that we tried that didn't work and why they didn't work and what we think. You know, I think we aren't very good at that. And so I would say, you know, this isn't necessarily transparency to the general public or to the media, but certainly to one another about where, sharing information about where we've failed and, you know, of course, where we've succeeded and helping and, you know, helping build a stronger community through that kind of, you know, mutual transparency with one another. So that's just one, and, you know, how best to do that, I don't have a solution to. I think it really depends on, you know, who we're talking to. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all. So I want to just make an encouragement that we're a little bit more transparent about that sort of thing with one another. The other thing I would just say, and this kind of goes back to all the good things that Brad's talking about, it is clearly legally permissible for a foundation to say that I am a private foundation. We do not have an open grant application process. We will decide who we make grants to and when, and that's clearly legal. What I would say is if that is your position, it behooves you to make that broadly known to as many people as possible. We used to do this. We didn't exactly have an anti-fraud division, but we weigh in from time to time, and back in the early 2000s, it was kind of this habit, these free money guides would go out and it'd list all these foundations that'll give you money for whatever your problem is. And some people would get inundated with like 15, 20,000 applications. And there's no way that they're qualifying for any program. But if you went to the foundation, they didn't have an annual report, they didn't have a website, just even as a defensive strategy, just saying, this is the way we make grants, don't apply, the internet has changed a lot of that. California Wellness is a good example. You can't even apply for a grant unless you've gone through and articulated which of the buckets and the things that they're doing that you're applying for. So I think, you know, to some extent, just being transparent about what you do and what you don't do, it's a little bit self-serving, but it also, it's good business, and it avoids unreasonable expectations about what you do. So I think whatever it is that you do, again, I would encourage everyone, you know, the first thing people do, they pull up their Bing search engine, and
very good.
And they try and find out what they can about the foundation. Like you said, you know, if they can't find out who to contact with, you're going to get a letter. You're going to have to open the mail. So I just encourage people to be very thoughtful about, you know, creating expectations within the community. And annual reports, the council was very big on annual reports, I think appropriately so, to just increase the transparency about what foundations do in very aggregate ways. Obviously printed annual reports with beautiful photographs and, you know, heavy stock paper aren't necessarily the best way to get things accomplished these days. But the concept of really being open, at least in sort of an annualized aggregate basis about some sense of what the foundation does, I've never seen anything that could be construed as that being a negative. Obviously, there's privacy issues that you can address in what you disclose. But I think that the, you know, getting away from printed annual reports has led some people away from the concept. And I think it's certainly worth reconsidering what it is that we want people to know about us, both from a good business perspective and a good defense is a strong offense sort of approach. Those are just a couple of thoughts I had.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment a little bit on glass pockets, because I think what Brad is trying to do in terms of showing what other foundations, how those are choosing to be more transparent, is it's extremely valuable resource. The one fear I might have with the kind of concept of the document checklist or whatever is the suggestion that I don't think Brad is making, but that the idea that transparency is an end state, and that if you just check off the boxes and you post certain documents, then you're transparent. And I think the concept, when the layperson, when they think about transparency, they aren't simply thinking about documents being put up or checklists. And again, I want to be careful. Brad is not suggesting this. But I think it really is a matter of what Andrew was saying, is we need to step back, reconsider, why am I sharing this? How am I sharing this? When am I sharing this? And it's really more of a journey than an end state. And this is true for small institutions. It's true for us as a large institution. We are still relatively young. We're still growing. And we still wrestle with, okay, what do the new technologies mean in terms of what we're able to do or what expectations are placed on us? And so there's not a formula, there's not a checklist. I think you always need to kind of revisit what makes sense for your own individual institution.
At that particular moment in time.
Let's have just quick with that. We actually developed this with partners. We didn't do it alone. We did it with the Center for Effective Philanthropy, with the Global Philanthropy Forum, with the Communications Network, with GEO, Grantmakers for Effective Organizations, and also with an English group called the One World Trust, which has a really interesting project called the Global Accountability Project, where they look at the accountability of multinational corporations, the World Bank, big sort of multilateral institutions, and international NGOs. And it's kind of surprising. They sometimes find that, in their last list, I think they found that Google was almost on the bottom in terms of its own transparency, which is kind of interesting to think about. And that sometimes the multinational corporations came out better than the NGOs, but we just felt they had really interesting experience. So we really pooled a lot of resources to come up with these tools and criteria. What we have found that's interesting is that some foreign foundations have used this as a tool and actually posted their profiles because they wanted some benchmarking. You know, this is a field where, and if any of you work with living donors, I mean, I feel like the old Groucho Marx show, I'll show my age, when you say the magic word and the duck drops down, benchmarking and leverage were sort of the two words that the donor I work for always wanted. He wanted to benchmark their foundation. And a lot of people have been using this as a benchmarking tool when they're thinking about developing their own website, sort of what things they can think about making available to the public. And I agree, it's a checklist, but I think we're even so far from having, as a field, having sort of a minimum standard of transparency that, I'm not so worried about a checklist right now.
Now, Brad, one of the questions for you on glass pockets, and I think you talked a little bit about this, does the Foundation Center go out and affirmatively pick foundations and do its assessment and analysis, or do foundations know about this process and come to it?
I mean, anything you put out on the internet today, you're competing against, a zillion different sites, and it has to be found, and people in foundations are busy, so, it's not everybody spends all their waking hours looking at this website, so there's a consciousness factor. We've had a trickle of foundations that have stepped forward, again, particularly smaller foundations, wanting to go through the process of having a profile done. We started out going to the largest foundations and sort of working our way down. It's a permission-based system, so we ask people if they're interested in going through this, and then we go through it, and then we ask them whether they agree to have it posted on a public website. And as I said, all but one have done it. So.
Right.
Okay. But it's a very laborious process, and in the larger staffed foundations, the communications people are really excited by it usually, and the general counsel's office is less excited by it. So there's sort of a Bermuda Triangle somewhere between those two that sometimes he's never emerged from.
I just want to comment a little bit on sort of social media and emerging opportunities. And I would just say, this goes back to the thing like, sometimes it's better not to do it than to do it wrong. And anyone who's visited my Facebook account and requested that I be their friend will think I don't understand what that word means because, I created the site. I'm never on it. And friends post things there thinking I'm going to see them. And it's almost worse. They think I'm kind of a jerk to begin with. But, your kid's 2 years old and I still haven't sent you a card and it's because I didn't check my Facebook site. So I think often, this knee-jerk reaction like, oh, I'm going to embrace the new thing and I'm going to be accountable and transparent and people know what I'm doing. You set it up, you're all excited and you're like, I don't even know how to use this or why. You leave it up there and then you don't ever respond to it. I think you can do, in some cases, if you're not doing it well, think about, again, go back to why are we doing this? What are we trying to accomplish? Right. And not just, check, hey, I want to be listed on the Twitter section of this really cool website. Well, then make sure you use it. So I just, that's things like be very deliberate about what we do. I think there's lots of different solutions. And I think by and large, transparency as a means to accomplishing things is a very attractive way to get a lot done. But think about exactly what you're trying to do and why.
Thank you.